As I understand it, we have an hour from now, and so we shall use that hour. I don't know what will work best for hearing and thinking. There are some kinds of thinking that work best when you're sitting on your brains, and sometimes better when you're standing on them. I don't know which is better this time. I'm going to start sitting. It feels better. Thank you for the chance to think together. That's what is the privilege of every teacher. Any teacher that thinks that he's in the business to tell people stuff is a lunatic. Teachers are in the business of thinking with people because you give us the privilege of thinking hard. We're going to work the next couple of weeks on creation stories, probably better called origin stories. Number of reasons for preferring origin stories. The chief reason is we're going to look at stories from not just Christian backgrounds, not even just Jewish background, but we're going to look at stories around the world. And one of the things you learn as soon as you start looking at creation stories around the world is that the word creation is a Christian import. It's in fact Christian contraband that's smuggled into the interpretation of stories, many of which in fact refuse the idea of a creator or creation at all. I find that fascinating, and therefore, in thinking in general about this area that I study, I prefer the term origin stories, because these are stories, finally, even the Jewish story, about how things originated, how the original shaped the subsequent, and how all that we are is stamped by the DNA of the way the world is made. So I will almost always refer to these stories as origin stories. You can do whatever you want, but it's important to notice that a lot of the ideas that hang around the idea of a creator, in fact, have very little to do, well, surely with stories around the world, and in fact, many of them have very little to do actually with the actual shape of Genesis 1 or Genesis 2 or any of the creation stories, origin stories, whichever you call them in Jewish scripture. There are, you know, there's more than one origin story in the Bible. There are, in fact, depending on how you count, six or seven. They are scattered all over the place, and not one of them presupposes any of the others. That's delightful. That is often really troubling to my fundamentalist students. At Augustana, I teach all sorts of folk. Some come with a remarkable catechetical background, and that catechetical background is Catholic or Lutheran or whatever. Some come with a remarkable catechetical background, and the background is fundamentalist. Some come with no background at all, and some come with a background that they are running from, for good reason or bad, often for very good reason. I get a great many students that are running from the stupid that inhabits too much of the Christian faith, anyway. Probably the stupid inhabits other faiths too, but as a Christian, I'm only responsible for Christian stupid. But it surprises, especially my fundamentalist students, to discover that there's more than one story. More than one story that creates the world. When I started teaching, I was very sure of myself, and I knew all things, which is a sure mark of a rookie who doesn't know hardly anything. I was very sure of myself, and I told them, well, it's just that way, take a look, there it is. Well, that's true. It is just that way, and you can take a look, and there it is, and that's indeed true. But that doesn't help one heck of a lot. As I have taught longer and listened better, I have picked up on a few things that have helped. One is a colleague who came to Augustana to teach for a few years, came from Norway, told me one day that There's an old Norwegian saying, and the saying is, a well-loved child has many names. And I like that. I like that because when he was at Augustana was when Zachary was just a little kid. And therefore, we had a perfect test case in Zachary, our now 13-year-old child. Zachary, who in fact will tell you, if you ask him his name, he'll tell you that his name is Zach. That's all he will ever say. I am, in fact, the only person on earth that gets to call him Zachary. His mother is not allowed to call him Zachary. No one else. If you call him Zachary, he'll say, my name is Zach. Or he'll look like, his face will look like he wished he could say that. Zach is his name, but he lets me call him Zachary. That's, I don't know why, but I like the name and he likes it when I use it. Everyone else calls him Zach. His older brothers called him Rugrat. His sister called him Pugger. I don't know why. As we listened, we realized that wherever these names come from, they come from love for sure. Think of the people that you love best. Do you have names for them? Have you had names for them that no one else even knew? A well-loved child has many names. A well-loved spouse has many names. A well-loved partner has many names. A well-loved friend has many, many names. I listened to my colleague and I realized that this might work for origin stories too. A well-loved world has many stories. A well-loved world requires many stories to bring it into full existence. Because any one of the stories that we've got brings part of the world into existence, not all of it. Any one of the stories, all of them delightful, all of them rich, all of them quirky, all of them strange. Oh, you should read the Hebrew. Some of these stories are amazing. They all bring a different quirk into the world that you wouldn't know was there. By the time we finish this run, I hope we have discovered a mess of those quirks. I'll do as much as I can to help, and I look forward to hearing what you discover. When they asked would I come to Holden, the answer was yes. Because probably my next writing project is origin stories. And I long ago learned that if you want to learn something, think about it with bright people. So y'all have a reputation. Thanks for the chance to be with you. I want to mess around tonight with stories in general. Tomorrow, we're going to start looking at specific stories from around the world. We're going to read a story from the Bashongo people. But tonight, I just want to think about what stories do. We're going to spend a couple of weeks thinking about stories in which the world is created. We need to think about how it is that stories work. Because there is, in American culture, an odd notion that the word story is half of a hyphenated word. The other half is mere. Mere story comes out as a joined, welded together unit when Americans talk about what stories are. Think about the last time you've heard someone say, ah, she's telling stories. What did they mean? She's lying. That's just a story. What does that mean? It means that whatever a story is, it's this depreciated little nothing that in fact is not worth anybody's real time, especially not serious adults like us. Wow, interesting. That means that unless we address that initially, we're going to spend our 2 weeks here, I'm going to spend my time and whatever of your time you would like to invest with me to help me think, we're going to spend our shared time investing in mere nothings. We all have better things to do than that. In American usage, mere story is a unit, an idea, a concept that we accept. I'd like to ask you to pretend, since we are engaged in foolish activities for the next while, hopefully not moronic activities, but foolish. I'd like to ask you to pretend, at least for the time that we sit and talk with each other, that there is no such thing as a mere story. Just for our time together, when you step out of here, of course, you can believe in mere stories if you like. You can believe that there's nothing but data and stories are just a waste of time fuzzing up the what would otherwise be clear. You can operate any way you need to operate to do what it is that you do, to be who it is that you are. But just for our time, please pretend with me that there is no such thing as a mere story. I want to tonight make an argument to the effect that it's not entirely foolish to say there is no mere story in the world. I want to start by talking about what it is that stories can do. Stories have remarkable powers. That's good, because if you're Jewish or Christian, you belong to a tradition that has invested a huge chunk of its scripture in story. For Jews and Christians, scripture means, in large part, story. There's all kinds of stories. There are implied stories, there are explicit stories, but there's a huge investment in the business of story. And therefore, it would be a good thing, for Jews and Christians anyway, if story in fact had some particular power. I want to suggest three. First one, whatever else stories are, whatever else stories do, stories project worlds. Stories project worlds. When you read a story, I'm supposing, as is normal for us, that stories come to us many times. All biblical stories mostly come to us printed on a page and we read them. We read them aloud, we read them silently, but as we read them, something happens. They project a world. That means that they don't stay fixed to the page, but they blow up around us and create a world that envelops us. That is an exceedingly important power of stories. If they just stayed an artifact on the page, little black marks on a white surface, they would perhaps be intellectually interesting, they might have data that would be worth looking at, but they would not be stories, because stories are stories when they blow a world up around you that envelops you, that seems whole and believable. I have been a nutsy reader all my life. Anyone else here a nutsy reader? There's always several of us, yes. And I have no intention of recovering from it. No, I am a nutsy reader for life. When I was a child, the rule in our house was the cereal boxes go on the floor at breakfast. Because if there's text, I'm reading it, riboflavin. It's hopeless. I read everything. If you have words on your shirt, I have read them already. I'll read them many more times because I cannot stop reading things. Who here has been reading a book and it's, you're just reading to read a chapter to get tired to go to sleep, okay? And you read a chapter and you say, oh, just one more chapter. And then you say, oh, but it's just a couple of chapters to the end of the section. And then it's just, you know, the next section is really short. I'll stop in the middle of the next chapter. Who here has done that? Who here has seen the sun come up? Yes. Well, you're still just reading to get sleepy. Yes. There is something about stories that blow up around me and all nutsy readers in a way that in fact envelops us and keeps us reading. It makes a world around us that's so real that it seems as real as any world we actually live in. My mother tells this story, so now I do too, of a time when I was about 12 years old. I was lying on the couch in the living room reading a book, probably a mystery, because I have been a lover of mystery since I was just a twerp. I read good mysteries, I read bad mysteries, I read anything. I was lying there reading probably a mystery. My mother comes into the living room and she said, "Would you close that book and go outside and play?" I said, "Mom, I can't. It's raining." Now, you need to know that I grew up in southern Minnesota, and this was January 10th. It was 12 degrees below zero outside. The only place it was raining was in the book that I was reading. Stories project worlds that are, for those of us that are susceptible, which finally is all of us, but some of us are hopeless. For those of us that are susceptible, those projected worlds are so believable that when you are in the narrative world, you are in the narrative world. I believed it was raining. I have friends, when they go on long distance driving trips, they bring a book and prop it up in the steering wheel. We don't live in the same part of the country, most of us, but if ever you encounter me on the highway and there's a book in the steering wheel, get off the road. Hide behind something made of stout concrete, because if the road in the book turns, I'm turning the steering wheel. Stories project worlds that are so persuasive that you swear in a good story that you could walk up to a character and ask him what he had for breakfast and he would tell you. Anybody here read Dorothy Sayers' mysteries? Anybody read? Now, I don't know what you think of Dorothy Sayers, but I have loved her mysteries forever because she tells stories of Lord Peter Wimsey and Harriet Vane. And these two, Lord Peter, is a detective. He discovers things. He figures things out. Harriet comes along initially. Harriet changes Lord Peter. Peter is changed by Harriet. All of a sudden, they develop. They grow into a couple. They grow into people that they never were. But always, the world around them is so fully fledged that I swear, you could ask Lord Peter what he has in his back pocket, and he would be able to tell you. Stories project worlds. Second thing, stories draw you into those worlds. Now, that's really like a special case of the first one, but grant me the indulgence. It's important to say that twice. Stories not only project worlds, if that's all they did, it would be a great magic trick. Heck of a magic trick. We could talk about the interesting philosophical phenomenon of projecting a world. But what happens is they grab you and pull you in so that you can't get back out. That's why you keep reading and reading and reading. That's also why on my bookshelf I have some books with a bookmark in them. 35 pages in. The bookmark is yellow, the binding of the book is arthritic, and the bookmark will never move because I read 35 pages and was not drawn in at all. I give a book 35 pages. I give a short story 3 paragraphs. I will sometimes give a book longer. My sister recommended a book. My sister's taste was impeccable. And it was, what was the title? 1,000 Days in Venice or something like that. I don't know. It was god-awful. But she loved it. And I read nearly 3/4 of it because she kept asking, "Well, did you read it? How do you like it?" I said, "Don't yet." But for my sister, I would read more than 35 pages, but not for any of y'all. Have you ever paid attention to what it is that hooks you when you read? When you're reading, what is it that pulls you inside a narrative? What dialogue. Gets you? What's that?
Dialogue.
Why?
Because it's real.
Yes. All dialogue? Do you like Hemingway's dialogue?
Yes.
Yes. I do too. A lot of people say no. Nobody talks in words that short.
I do.
I know a lot of people that talk just like that. Faulkner's dialogue?
I haven't read much of
that. Ooh, yeah. Faulkner's dialogue flows like the bayous of the Mississippi that he writes in the middle of. The round the corner and back this way. But I love that too. When a writer can get two characters to talk to each other so that you feel them discover things. I'll read that until I'm old and purple. What else hooks you? What gets you when you read?
I just finished In the Mists of the Confederate Dead, James Lee Burke.
I haven't read that.
I think you will enjoy it.
Yes.
But there, a detective.
Yes.
Cajun detective.
Ooh.
And he is getting kind of tired and burned out by his job, and he sees these Confederate soldiers in the mist. And another character in the book sees him too, but his chief thinks he needs a rest.
Yes.
To answer, so I've taken a long time to tell you, but that little bit of magic.
Yes, yes. I was raised by a father who trained me to look at the world as a scientist, because my father believes that any real education is grounded in the physical sciences. And that means that as a little child, I was taught to ask cause and effect, what are they, how are they linked? I am not one that uses the word magic, except sometimes. And inside narratives, there are things that are magic, and I will follow them always and forever. Partly because you need magic to have full human life. Father believes that too. I didn't know it at the time. But partly because you need also the rigorous pursuit of cause and effect. And so narrative is the place where I find the magic that supplements. I need it. Thank you. What else hooks you?
Anything else?
For me, it's the characters. I get to where I just want to know what happens to them.
Yes.
And couple of books where I felt that something bad was going to happen to them, I would stop reading.
Yes, because as long as you stopped, the
weight
would never fall on their head.
Right.
Yes, suspense means that there's something hanging over them that's going to crush them like the sections out of the big dig in Boston.
Just,
when you're reading
the
story,
so good,
you can
I just
see
didn't
it.
Want it to end, so I'd stop reading.
Yes. Have you ever finished a book and been mad at yourself for reading the last page? Yes. What's that?
I never do that.
No. I do sometimes. And usually I'm glad of sequels to allow me to keep going. But sometimes, oh. But yeah. What else?
Well, I just finished today the Franny and Zooey that the discussion room is going to talk about, and I had only read Catcher in the Rye, but I loved his description of that Manhattan apartment.
Yes.
I've been there after I read that.
Yes. And he gets it. He gets the grittiness. He gets the actualness. He gets the way it actually feels and looks and lives. Salinger's physical descriptions have always hooked me. Yeah. And his understanding of the quirks of the human mind. I love Salinger. I haven't read Franny and Zooey for a long time, but I'm excited to do it again. Oh, pay attention to the things that hook you when you read, because the stories that we're going to think about, the stories we're going to play with, will have those things in them. Sometimes it's suspense, sometimes it's character, sometimes it's the way the characters talk to each other, sometimes it's that odd element of magic. Because in fact, if worlds need magic to be whole, well, maybe you don't buy that.
I think so. What grabs a lot of people besides myself are your comparison and metaphors that people use that really make things so vivid.
Yes. You got me going in 92 directions. Stories are crucial because of the way they teach us to slam ideas together that we would not have slammed otherwise. They make our metaphors richer than they would have been. But they also reveal the way metaphor opens up the tensions in real life. Our son Zachary, he's a lunatic, you'll like him. As a child, had the strangest gift for metaphor.
Really?
Because he would look at things and slam ideas together in ways that tell me that maybe someday this kid's a storyteller. I am waiting to see. He looked at a cloud dark on the sky just above the setting sun, and he said, "Looks like a skid mark on the sky." 5 years old, strange kid. But that kind of slamming together of images is something that a good storyteller provides us. And that slamming together, metaphor, by the way, means two things are linked together that have nothing to do with each other. Metaphor is about the vibration between them and the way they fight with each other. That fighting is the way, is where a story cracks open larger truths. Pay attention to the things that hook you. Pay attention to the things that are revealed when you are drawn into a story, because those things will be true also in the stories that we're looking at these few sessions. Third thing, stories project worlds. They draw you into those worlds. They also, by the way, subcase of the second one, they give you a place to stand. That's a big deal, probably worth mentioning here. When stories draw you in, they don't just draw you in and then turn you loose. They provide a place that you stand that allows you to see the action going by you, and you can make sense of it from that particular viewpoint. That's really important, because that is a constructed platform on which you're standing. The image I use when I teach my students at Augustana is I ask how many of them watch soap operas. I don't know if you all have watched soap operas, but who has? At any time? Okay, how do you know on a soap opera who it is to dislike? How do you know who to dislike on a soap opera?
The music.
Yes. Because you listen, you watch the show, and presumably the characters aren't hearing the music. It would be a really good, there was a Woody Allen movie where he was hunting for the orchestra that was playing music and found him in a closet. The characters do not presumably hear the music, but you do, and that says, dun-dun-da. Well, something is going to happen. How else do you know?
By the other characters' reactions?
Yes, sometimes the other characters look at this one and say, "What a rat." Does anybody remember Roger? Decades ago now on, I forget, what was it, As the World Turns? Roger, the rat of all rats. He was such a rat, he died twice. One time was thrown out of an airplane and survived. Roger was a rat, but he was a rat that everyone trusted. Everyone loved him. They trusted their children to him. They trusted their stock portfolios to him. They trusted everything to him. And then when they smiled and turned away, Roger glowed. Because Roger was going to eat their lunch on him. Well, he always did. How did we know that? The storyteller showed us Roger's face when no one else got to see it. That's part of the platform that you get to stand on. When a story is told, you are given a platform that shows you Roger's face when he's being a rat, even if no one else gets to see it. It lets you hear the music that says, "Here's something not to trust," even when no one else can hear it. Pay attention when you listen to any of these stories, what the platform is like. That's especially important because one of the things you learn when you study literature is that the fact that an author or a storyteller built a platform for you to stand on does not mean that you have to stay there. The technical term for that is deconstruction, but what it means is if you're reading the story and it tells you that the only characters with brains are baritones, and every woman has moths flying around in her head, the story might yet be worth reading, but not on that platform, for Pete's sake. You are free to walk across the room and watch the parade from a different angle. In fact, sometimes you are required to walk across the room. And sometimes you learn the most about the kinds of stories that you read customarily if you intentionally walk across the room and read it from an angle that you're not accustomed. That's in fact why we're going to be cross-reading stories from all over the world with the stories out of Genesis. Not because I'm an omnimath and know everything about these cultures that anyone needs to know. I know very little. It's embarrassing how little I know. The mountain of things that I don't know about the stories that we're going to look at is larger than the ones just outside of the valley here. What we're going to do is use them to walk us across the room and look at biblical stories from an angle that we're not used to. It's a good service they provide. And with some luck amongst us, we have more knowledge, and that'll sharpen our ability to look from across the valley back at our own stories. But that freedom to walk and read critically, to read against the grain, is absolutely crucial for faithful reading and faithful interpretation of the stories that we're looking at. Okay, third thing. Stories project worlds and draw you into them. Third thing that stories do is they create roles and expectations and ways of seeing the world. Now, in years of teaching this, that's always proved to be the point that's hardest for my students to get. I teach mostly 18 to 22-year-olds. And so when I say stories create roles, they think, probably with the Russian formalists, well, or not necessarily, that means that there are roles like hero and villain, protagonist, antagonist inside the story. Sure, that's true, but that's not what I'm talking about. They think when I say stories create expectations, that means something like you can feel the suspense hanging over your head. That's really crucial, but that's not what I mean. Sometimes they think that I mean when I say they create ways of seeing the world. Stories project worlds and give you ways also of seeing those worlds. Yes, of course, but no, that's not what I mean. Here's what I mean. I grew up in southwestern Minnesota in the 50s. The town I lived in got two channels on television, and one of them not all the time. That meant that I grew up, as everyone in my generation in southwestern Minnesota did, watching on Saturday morning cowboy shows, because it was all that was on TV. And so we watched, me and all of my friends, we watched Fury, my friend Flicka, we watched Roy Rogers, we watched Hopalong Cassidy, we watched Red Ryder. Red Ryder was my favorite because my cousin had given me a Red Ryder jean jacket, and I felt so cool. I could wear my Red Ryder jacket and watch Red Ryder on the TV. It was really cool. We watched all of those things, and as soon as they were done, we had quick lunch, and then we ran out to the vacant lot by Kevin Lau's house, and we played Cowboys, of course. Now, there are certain rules that go with playing cowboy. In order to play cowboy, you've got to live in cowboy land. You've got to inhabit cowboy world. And in cowboy world, there are certain things that everyone has to be able to do. You've got to be able to ride and rope and shoot. And you also have to say it that way. So we would meet on the vacant lot next to Kevin Lau's house, and we would ride and rope and shoot. You do need to know that at that point in my life, I had never been on a horse. My father had quit hunting long before I was old enough to learn how, so I couldn't shoot anything. And as for roping, oh, it was hopeless. I didn't know what to do then or now. But when we met and played, we were all of us riding, roping, shooting fools. How could we do that? The stories that we had watched, the stories that had enveloped us, had created roles that we knew how to play. We could shoot the eye out of a squirrel at 300 yards because we needed to in the stories that we were playing. But of course, living in cowboy world requires more than riding, roping, and shooting. It requires especially doing things noble. In cowboy world, people just want to live peaceable like, if you remember cowboy world, and you also have to say it like that. Everyone just wants to live peaceable like. But when people are trying to live peaceable like in cowboy world, all of a sudden, terrible danger erupts, right? And when terrible danger erupts, somebody's got to stand up and do what's right. And you got to say it that way, too. Week after week, we met on the lot. People tried to live peaceable like. Terrible danger would erupt. Sometimes it was Fred Hall who was terrible danger. Sometimes it was Mike Crick. Sometimes it was me. And when terrible danger erupted, somebody had to stand up and do what's right. We were a bunch of dumb kids from southern Minnesota. We didn't know noble from a hole in the ground. But week after week, we laid down our lives for our friends. We did noble things that were incredible. Self-sacrifice everywhere you looked. How did we know how to do that? The stories created in us the competence that allowed us inside the game to do things that were noble. Now, if it just went that far, that'd be terrific. That'd be astonishing. That would be a wonderful effect of the television narrative enacted in children's play, and we could probably do a sociological study and have a great deal of fun and get funded, and that'd be marvelous. But the thing that matters is it doesn't stop there. The thing that matters is those roles, those expectations, those ways of seeing the world that we took from the television to the vacant lot stick with you. There is, truth be told, a little cowboy that lives right about here in my head. A set of expectations. People just want to live peaceable life. Terrible danger will erupt. Somebody's got to do what's right. A set of expectations that I carry with me even now. If you ask my colleagues at Augustana, next time you see Murray, ask him, he'll tell you. Every once in a while, there's a faculty meeting, and I'm sitting there. As near as I can tell, everybody in the room is trying to live a peaceable life. All of a sudden, someone proposes an idea that sounds like terrible danger to me. And I sit there and I try to be peaceable-like. I try hard to be peaceable-like, but finally someone's just got to stand up and do what's right. And so I stand up and make arguments, principal arguments about as near as anyone can tell, nothing. If you ask my colleagues, they'll say to each other, it's just Swanson being a cowboy again. They're right. I carry with me roles that I still play, expectations that I still use, and ways of seeing the world that I still find productive. Now, I've read more than cowboy stories in my life, and I've studied more than just those simple, bizarre narratives. But those narratives are still in force. That matters, because when we look at origin stories, we look at the origins of human being also now. And so the roles that are played inside the story will create roles that are played inside the culture that reads those stories. The expectations that you develop inside the story are expectations that you will then see in the culture that reads those stories as scripture. And the ways of seeing the world that are planted inside those old stories will show up in the culture that looks at the world through those stories. That's why stories are magic. These mere stories create whole worlds that whole cultures live in and use these stories as lenses to understand things that would otherwise be too hard to see. Aristotle. Anybody read Aristotle's Poetics? Oh, you had something.
I was just going to ask you, I became upset with Camus and some other writers.
Yes.
Because I felt that if you live with inside those stories, it was not good for everybody.
I end up with Camus feeling that way more about some stories than others. The plague feels to me more wholesome than The Stranger, for instance.
Yeah.
But yeah, that ends up being, I think, the most important task that a reader of any story, a participant in any story has, is to look carefully at what roles and expectations and ways of seeing the world are inculcated by this story. What does being part of this story do to me? Is this way of looking at the world making me human, or is it making me something other? Is this way of looking at the world killing the human heart, the human hope within me, or is it nurturing it? Now, that's not an easy question to answer, but it is the key question to ask. Aristotle's Poetics, let me do a little bit there. I don't know if you've read Aristotle's Poetics. In the teaching that I get to do, I get to read it again every year or two, and it's a delightful piece. It's the oldest piece of literary analysis that we have existing as a whole. And it is a marvelous piece. Aristotle is studying dramatic theater, tragedy in particular. But as with all things Aristotelian, he is so remarkably thorough that you can take what he does analyzing dramatic narrative and apply it all around, because it's just good. If you have not read Aristotle recently, or if you, as so many students who read Aristotle briefly and then never more, if you find him incredibly and annoyingly detailed, well, of course he is. But what I've found with Aristotle is that, in fact, it's the simple parts that are important. Aristotle in the Poetics discusses the multiple uses of the letter rho. Who cares? I do, because I'm a Greek nerd. But you shouldn't care. No one else should. He talks about the significance of doubled consonants. Students read it and they think, wow, this must be really hard. I should read it because there's something here. No, not necessarily. I tell students that one of these years I'm actually going to do it. I'm going to require them, when I assign Aristotle, to buy from the bookstore a rubber stamp that has one word on it, and that one word is duh. Because in Aristotle, the simple parts are the important parts. So Aristotle, talking about dramatic narrative, says, what is a proper narrative? He says, a proper narrative is that which has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Everybody? Duh. Then he goes on to say, what is a proper beginning? A proper beginning, says Aristotle, is that before which there is nothing and after which there is everything. One, two, three. Duh. And what is a proper ending, says Aristotle? A proper ending, says Aristotle, is that after which there is nothing and before which there is everything. Duh. And what's a middle? Well, you guessed it. Everything in the middle. The thing that's important is Aristotle has just said something incredibly profound. Because he just said that a proper narrative is not like real life. Because real life does not have beginnings and does not have ends. Real life is therefore, says Aristotle, unthinkable, unknowable. It's a rush of chaotic detail that we can't think about, can't ever make any sense of. It's unintelligible, which means we can't intellige it, I suppose. Because it is just a rushing mass of raw, disordered detail. How do we make order so that we can think? Aristotle says we tell stories. We provide a beginning, the middle, and an end. And that makes the rush of raw life thinkable. And when I tell my students, they don't believe me. I don't know if you believe me at this point either. I tell them that in real life there are no beginnings. Students are sure that's not true because the people I teach are 18 to 22 year olds and they therefore are powerfully enmeshed in the beginnings and endings of relationships, especially. And they think about that, even obsess about that a lot. Because they should. This is a huge part of their lives. And so beginnings of relationships are profound things, and they know just when beginnings are. Except they don't. I tell them that my wife and I, actually, as of the 21st of June, my last day here, we will have been married 33 years. My wife is a generous woman. She let me go here so that we'll celebrate our anniversary off the date. But as of June 21st, we will be married 33 years. I tell my students, that means, of course, that our relationship began 33 years ago. Because one day I was walking down the street and accidentally happened to wander into a church, who knew? And up front there's this woman in a white dress, and I thought, wow, why not get married? No. Before that's the engagement. Ah, yes, one day I found a ring in my hand, didn't know what it was there for, so I gave it to the first person I saw and said, why not? No. Before that is the dating, before that is the asking, before that is the noticing, before that is the wondering. When does the relationship actually begin? In the case of my wife and me, it's really difficult to tell, because my wife was my sister's best friend since grade school. I have no idea when I met her first. Not a clue. She was just always sort of around. I remember the first words that I remember saying to her. I'm 2 years older than my wife. I was therefore a senior in high school, cool as it's possible to be. Sitting in the lunchroom, there were places across the table from me. My wife walked in with my sister. Didn't know she was my wife, but she was my sister. And they were 2 years younger, and I figured they were coming to sit across from the cool older brother. My sister used to tell me, nah, you weren't that cool. They were just sitting where there was a space. They sat down. Across from me was my wife-to-be. Didn't know, but I remembered I'd seen her. Didn't remember what her name was for sure. Thought I should say something suave, so I did. I said, you should eat your cheese. It will make you constipated. These are the first words that I remember saying to her. Now, if I told you a story about our relationship and began at that point, how would the story go? Well, it would be a story that had lots of occasions for my poor wife to roll her eyes and say, yes, I do believe he said that. Yes, he does that all the time. And it would be a true story. There have been all sorts of moments where my wife got to say exactly those words. Still does. I could tell you the story and begin it instead at our wedding. We were married in Pipestone, Minnesota, on the 21st of June in 1975, and if any of you happened accidentally and against your will to be in that place at that time, you might remember that it was 98 degrees in the afternoon with 94% humidity. By the time of the wedding, it had cooled down considerably. It was 97 degrees and 96% humidity, which meant, because this was 1975 and no one had air conditioning in their houses, at least no one with an income like my dad's, and there were no churches with air conditioning, my memories of the wedding are mostly memories of sweating. And so we're standing up in the front, and we are sweating. I'm doing a very good job. I'm imagining that my wife is, too, doing a very good job of sweating. And I can feel the sweat dripping from the small of my back and piling up on my belt. And I'm wondering, I wonder, will the sweat show through my brown fringed cuff tuxedo? I wonder, it would be interesting. I'm not sure, but it could, and I'm wondering if that's the case. And I'm watching, and I'm noticing that our pastor is sweating more than I am, which goes, takes some doing. He's sweating so that it's dripping off his nose. Now, I had been reading chaos theory at the time and was intrigued by the fact that you can't predict when the next drop will fall from a faucet because there are too many variables, and so all of it, they just fall when they fall. And so I'm wondering, does that hold for noses too? So when you get married, you gotta keep yourself busy because there's a lot going on, but who knows? So I'm there watching, I'm counting, and one, two, oh, no, you can't, it works for noses just like faucets. And just drip it away. Whoa, now this is 1975, and Lutherans at the time still had the old red book, which meant that anyone with any creativity wrote their own marriage service, partly because it was, well, 1975, and partly because the old wedding service had things in it like eds and eths and all that, in the end. And I have a slight lisp, but I can't say any of those things, so we were glad to ditch them. They also had lines like, and thereunto do I plight thee my troth, and none of us knew what a troth was or how you would plight one, so we dispensed with the service and wrote our own. And so we'd written it, and we'd written the prayers, we'd written the readings, we'd written everything. We wrote the vows. We had done a bang-up job, and our pastor had taken notes on it all in little 3x5 cards with his fountain pen. And he was standing on the stand. Washable blue ink. And about 2/3 of the way through the service, he looked down, and his eyes got whites all the way around. This is not something you want to see in your pastor when you, in fact, are just trying to keep yourself from fainting. Whites all the way around his eyes, and he showed us the cards, and there was not a single readable word on the card. It was an even blue wash. He said, we're on our own, follow me. And from that point on, he made up the entire service. He made up responsive readings. How do you make up responsive readings? He made up responsive readings. He made up prayers. He made up everything. People afterwards said, what a beautiful service you wrote. He said, yes, it was. But we didn't ever tell him. If I started the story of our relationship there, what would it be a story about? It'd be a story with a lot of sweating and a whole lot of improvising. Also a true story. I could start the story one other place and tell you about the wedding service itself. At the beginning, it was 97 degrees. At the end of the service, it was 67 degrees because a thunderstorm rolled through. There are parts of the 8-track tape, which if you could still listen to it from the service, you can't hear a word because the thunder is so loud. There was a tornado a couple of counties over. The thunder was so loud that it obliterated all sound. And if I started the story of our relationship there, it would be a story about thunder and lightning and some cause for fear. And that also would be a true story. The point for Aristotle is that each one of these beginnings tells a true story because it orders the facts that are otherwise too multiple to ever make sense of. There are too many variables. Chaos theory is right, but stories tame the chaos. And that's crucial for what we're doing when we look at origin stories. Because stories tame the chaos so that you can make sense. Do you notice the manufacturing metaphor? That's a big deal. You make sense of the world by telling stories about it. Just by way of finishing, I'd like to read you the beginning. Two stories. The first one is the one that we're going to look at tomorrow. It's a story with the title, charming title, Bumba Vomits the World. This is an ideal story for teaching seventh graders. Any story would vomit it. But let me read you just the first line. Couple of lines. And I'm going to ask you to tell me what kind of story this might be. In the beginning, in the dark, there was nothing but water, and Bumba was alone. One day, Bumba was in terrible pain. He retched and strained and vomited up the sun. After that, light spread over everything. Now, there's a lot more to the story, and we'll look at it closely tomorrow, but just for now, what do you hear? What's this going to be a story about? In the beginning, in the dark, there was nothing but water, and Bumba was alone. One day, Bumba was in terrible pain. He retched and strained and vomited up the sun. After that, light spread over everything. What do you hear? What do you notice?
It's like the Bible.
Is that the
origin?
The origin. This is a story that, in fact, since the first words were in the beginning, this is a story that tells you something about what a beginning looks like in this world. Thus.
Water world.
What's that?
Water world.
It's water world. There was nothing but water.
Sounds like a metaphor.
Sounds like a metaphor. Because for there to be nothing but water, water has to then mean something. There is no time in our experience of the world where there's nothing but water unless you are drowning.
Well, there's the retching and the beauty as well.
Unless what?
Then there's the retching and then the earth is lit, or the world is lit. So there's
yes.
This disturbing image of retching up the sun, and then the sun was everywhere and lit everything.
And that interchange between the intense pain and the retching, what a word. It's one of those words that feels like it means. Retching is followed by, after that light spread over everything. There's a strange interchange in this world between retching and the gentle spread of life.
Does anyone else remember vomiting as a child in the dark and in bed? And you know, you're
And I had read the Child's Garden of Verses and setting out to sea in my boat at night. So, you know, my bed is a boat, and I vomit, and I haven't eaten recently, and so it's yellow bile.
Yes. Oh. And this story begins a world in yellow bile. That's an odd beginning to a world. There is yellow bile in the world, and we have each tasted it. But this world begins with that taste, or begins with the surprise of vomiting as a child. I watched our kids, we had four, watch them amazed by the fact that they were vomiting. Later on they learned, and they would cry at a time, but the littlest ones, they just erupt, and then they're puzzled by it. Does this world begin that way? Or does this world begin with adult vomiting, which is a different thing? Wow, did you think you'd talk about this that much about vomiting? Probably not, but look at this world. It starts you thinking about this unease that yields the easy spread of light.
I was hearing pain and wretching and saw it as a metaphor for birth.
Yes.
Because
yes.
It's painful and it's a kind of a wretching too.
And what's it mean? We're going to look at that in detail tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
But if this is, in fact, a birth metaphor, I've watched four births up close, learned from them something that amazed me at the time and embarrassed me and led me to be ashamed. Our first child, when he was finally born, weighed 10 pounds, 12 ounces. Yes. The doc did not call him by his name, he called him Bull Moose. My wife dilated quickly in less than an hour, and then pushed for 5 hours. In the middle of that, I realized this is one of those things that I, again, wish I knew you better. I wish you knew me.
Sounds good to know you.
I realized sitting on the windowsill, the nurse would not allow me to sit in the doctor's chair, while my wife pushed into her fourth hour, that though I normally, in fact, deal with the pain of the world by wishing I could carry it, when your children are sick, you wish you could be sick instead of them. Children hurt, you wish you could hurt instead of them. When my son broke his arm, I wished I could have broken both my arms rather than his ones. Though that is a very normal reaction in me, I sat on the windowsill and did not feel that. I sat on the windowsill and, to my shame, realized I was glad it was my wife and not me, because I was not sure I could do it. And think of me what you will, but it's true. It was an experience that shook me, and I was the one who was uninvolved. This story begins with a pain. Not all births are so difficult. Zachary correctly shot out. Not all births are so difficult, more difficult than I would know, but not all are so difficult as Eric's birth was. But what if this story begins with that depth of pain that left me breathless at my wife's strength, astonished at her endurance, and amazed at her willingness simply to go on when I couldn't imagine going at it at all? What if this story begins and says, here's what the world comes out of, that it requires precisely that depth of pain?
What about chaos?
Yes. Do you hear the chaos? Where do you hear the chaos?
I hear the chaos in the pain and suffering and vomiting, and then suddenly there's light.
Well, suddenly there's light. It may mean that this is a world that, in the midst of what ought to be desperate and wretched circumstances, life suddenly alights. Tomorrow we will dig at that and play with it, just to see what else we can find. There's a lot more. To finish tonight, let me read you a couple of lines from the Jewish story, the first one. In the beginning, when God began to create the heavens and the earth was a formless void, and darkness covered the face of the deep, while a wind from God swept over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. And God saw that the light was good. In Hebrew, that's an okay translation. But the last words are so much better in Hebrew. God saw that the light was good, yeah, sure. In Hebrew, it's better to translate, and God saw the light. Ki tov. That means, oh, how good. Mm-hmm. What kind of world does that create? We'll look at that slowly and in pieces. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your voices. Thank you for your thinking. Let's see what we can do tomorrow.